Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the New Yorker political scene. My name is Russ Finkelstein. We've made it to episode 9. That's almost double digits. So thank you for being with me. If you're enjoying this podcast, please like it and review it on the podcast app that you're listening to, if you haven't done so already, of course, and share it with your friends and your family. Maybe share it with those good liberals you know who enjoy the analysis by Evan Osnos, Susan Glasser, and Jane Mayer, and who might be really annoyed to hear me picking apart everything they say. Or share it with someone who you think might agree with me politically and might find it gratifying to hear someone take those dum-dums to task. My point is, I would appreciate it if you help me spread the word about this podcast so we can grow the audience, and eventually I can get rich off of this and quit my day job and move to Brazil. Anyway, let's get into it. Let's see what's happening over on the New Yorker's Political Scene podcast, which started this week with a discussion about Russia and the United States exchanging hostages or prisoners, including Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich.
I mean, I do think the most amazing story out today, the most amazing story you'll read, is a piece in the Wall Street Journal explaining the full saga, this really epic story of how Evan Gershkovich was freed. And it is a wild story. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah. You know, I dare you to look at the video of Evan being reunited on the tarmac, first hugging President Biden and Vice President Harris, and then running over to his mom and lifting her in the air. It is a real tearjerker.
So I agree that it's a good thing that Evan Gershkovich and these other people were released in this prisoner or hostage exchange and through diplomatic means. I think that that's a great precedent to show that Russia and the United States and all these other Western countries can negotiate and solve these problems diplomatically. I understand the argument that by participating in these sorts of exchanges, the United States and the West might be incentivizing arbitrary detentions in the future. But at a certain point, if you care about the people in question, doing these sorts of deals helps them directly, and it sets a precedent for diplomacy, which I think is a good thing. I do think, though, it's worth pointing out that since the war started in Gaza, there has been discussion on the New Yorker political scene about the war and the U.S. response to it and the U.S. domestic politics of the war. I have not yet heard them mention the more than 100 journalists who have been killed in Gaza. Now, obviously, Evan Gershkovich is American, so maybe there's a bias there because the New Yorker political scene's hosts are also American. It's just so stark that so many journalists are being killed in a war funded by the United States. Just one recent example I find to be incredibly disturbing. Two Al Jazeera journalists were killed in an Israeli airstrike, and Israel admitted that they targeted those journalists intentionally. I'm reading now from a Committee to Protect Journalists report that came out earlier today as I record this on Wednesday. The title of the report is Journalists and Media Workers Reported Killed, Missing, or Injured. It's a running tally of all the information CPJ has collected about these cases. So, July 31st, 2024, Ismail Al-Ghul. Al-Ghul, a 27-year-old Palestinian journalist working for the Qatar-funded Al Jazeera Arabic TV channel, was killed in an Israeli strike on a car he and his colleague Rami Al-Rafi were using in Al-Shati camp near Gaza City, according to Al Jazeera and multiple news sources. The Israeli Defense Forces confirmed on August 1st that it had killed Al-Ghul in an airstrike, alleging that he was a member of Hamas's military wing and that, quote, his activities in the field were a vital part of Hamas's military activity. According to the IDF, Al-Ghul had instructed other operatives on how to record operations and, quote, was actively involved in recording and publicizing attacks against IDF troops. Basically, the IDF is accusing Al-Ghul of doing reporting, of filming and disseminating images that the Israeli Defense Force says are detrimental to their military efforts. And they've admitted to targeting him for assassination because of this. Of course, if these two Al Jazeera journalists worked for the Wall Street Journal or were American, we would probably be hearing a lot more about it in the Western press. Anyway, for a show that likes to think of itself as being concerned with the well-being of journalists and press freedom, I hope that the hosts of the political scene read this CPJ report. Just one more excerpt from the top of that report before I move on. As of August 7th, 2024, CPJ's preliminary investigation showed at least 113 journalists and media workers were among the 40,000 killed since the war began, making it the deadliest period for journalists since CPJ began gathering data in 1992.
I really enjoyed that Biden had such a good response quickly on his feet when he was asked to respond to Trump claiming he could have done better. And he said, oh, really? Well, why didn't he do it when he was president? Kind of one of those mic drop moments.
I don't think you have to be a brain genius to know what is wrong with that mic drop moment, as Jane Mayer called it. Of course, I'm referring to the fact that Evan Gershkovich was arrested on March 29th, 2003. That would be 2 years and 2 months after Donald Trump left the White House. You would hope that three highly regarded political writers from The New Yorker would have that in mind, but they either don't or they just sit on their hands because they just like the ring of it. They like the way that it makes them feel, that Joe Biden was able to get Gershkovich released and Donald Trump couldn't. Now, both Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser are also analysts for CNN. And their colleague, Daniel Dale, who's a CNN fact checker, wrote this article the day that Biden made those comments. Fact check, Trump, who approved multiple prisoner exchanges, falsely claims he gave up, quote, nothing to get Americans back. And it goes on to detail all of the different deals Donald Trump made in order to win the release of Americans. A 2019 exchange with Iran, a 2019 exchange with the Taliban, a 2020 exchange with Iran, a 2020 exchange with Iran-backed Houthis. So Donald Trump did make multiple deals to win the release of Americans from various adversaries, but he wasn't able to win the release of Evan Gershkovich because he stopped being the president on January 20th of 2021. So the main theme of this week's episode is actually campaign ads and the new campaign ads from the Harris and Trump campaigns. And so Jane Mayer's favorite campaign ad so far is this sort of biographical ad that the Harris campaign put out about who she is and what she stands for.
And what I like about it, it's a very standard bio ad in many ways, introducing her, but it specifically casts her in economic populist terms. And I've been waiting forever for the Democrats to engage with Trump on populist terms.
Okay, so honestly, I did not see that coming. I didn't realize that Jane Mayer was like a Bernie Sanders, Democratic Socialist of America style Democrat. And of course, if you've listened to the political scene or read her articles, you know that, in fact, she's not. Now, this prompted me to go do some digging to see what she had to say about Bernie Sanders and his agenda in 2016 and 2020. And it was pretty difficult to find anything substantive. But to her credit, Jane Mayer did publish a book in 2016 called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And a good friend of mine, who's also a great reporter, told me he's read this book and that it's very good and very well researched. Now, I don't doubt that, and I haven't read the book myself, but from what I can gather, it does seem to focus mostly on the amount of money in politics on the right. Now, what I did come across in my research that I find really amusing is that Jane Mayer went on Bernie Sanders' show, The Bernie Sanders Show, to promote her book. The focus of most of that conversation is on the Koch brothers and their influence on the Republican Party, but I think listeners of this podcast will find this excerpt particularly interesting.
It's really eye-opening when you do the reporting and you get down to, and you really press on what they're pushing
and
for.
And I think it's fair to say there have been, mainstream media has not really, you know, everybody knows the name Koch brothers, their impact, the amount of money they spend, but there's really been very little discussion of what they actually stand for.
Well, on this issue, I'm probably more of a fan of the mainstream media than you are, because I know what a struggle it is to be a reporter and try to get these stories. It took me 5 years to do this book, and it's hard. It's hard, and I think, you know, I come out of the mainstream media, so I have to defend my people.
All right. Well, you defend them.
Okay.
I just find that so endearing and, frankly, honest. I'm not really sure what her point is, that the book was really hard to write and it took her 5 years. Is she trying to say that that is why the mainstream media doesn't talk more about the Koch brothers? This interview took place in 2017, when I think the Koch brothers had more protagonism in the Republican Party than they do now. So maybe she's saying that without the backing of the mainstream media, she would not be able to do the reporting that she's doing. But I think that the more telling part of her answer is when she says she's a member of the mainstream media and therefore will defend it. I'd say we could probably extrapolate further on that and say she is a Washington, D.C. Democratic Party insider and will therefore defend that as well. Now, back to the Harris campaign ad that Jane Mayer said was her favorite so far in this cycle.
But Donald Trump wants to take our country backward, to give tax breaks to billionaires and big corporations and end the Affordable Care Act. But we are not going back.
And she casts herself as a fighter against the big banks, against big pharma, and has a record to show that from her days as a prosecutor. So I actually think of her ads, that's the most important, making that contrast.
I actually don't have much to disagree with here when it comes to this take. I think economic populism and the willingness of candidates really from either major political party to take on big business and corporate greed is a good sales pitch. My hope is that besides it being a good sales pitch, it's something that the candidates will also live up to. And I think a large part of the political mess that the country's in now is that politicians aren't always fighting for the interest of the voters. They're fighting for the interest of the donors to their campaigns. I would love to feel like that's going to change finally. But as of yet, I'm not entirely convinced that Harris is going to be that change. Now look, maybe I'm wrong about this, but one person who seems to share that concern is CNN's Jake Tapper. Recently, he had the LinkedIn founder and Democratic Party mega donor Reid Hoffman on his show to ask him about comments he made suggesting that if elected, Kamala Harris should fire the head of the FTC, Lina Khan, who's become one of the more progressive figures in the Biden administration and has used her position atop of the FTC to go after corporations on antitrust violations. Now, this clip is a bit longer than the ones I normally play on this show, but I do think it's worth listening to so that you can hear just how ridiculous Reid Hoffman's logic is, while keeping in mind that he does have the ear of people like the President of the United States, in large part because of the amount of money he's given to their campaigns.
Rich Democratic donors and business leaders are contributing money to Vice President Kamala Harris's presidential campaign, but some are asking, is there a catch? Some of these donors are now openly suggesting Harris should replace the head of the Federal Trade Commission, progressive darling Lina Khan. Khan is a progressive antitrust icon. She's aggressively been trying to prevent big tech, big oil, and others from forming monopolies, she says, ones that could wipe out smaller businesses. On Monday, media mogul and Democratic donor Barry Diller said he would lobby Kamala Harris to remove Lina Khan. And there is a similar sentiment being expressed by mega donor Reid Hoffman, who donated $10 million to the Biden-Harris campaign and is planning on a major fundraising push for Kamala Harris.
I do think that Lina Khan is a person who is not helping America in her job and what she's doing. And so I would hope that Vice President Harris would replace her.
So Reid Hoffman joins us now. Reid, thanks for joining us. So you and other big money donors are giving money to Vice President Harris, suggesting also that she replace the head of the FTC, which impacts policy and the economy. What do you say to somebody who watches this and says, this isn't how American politics should work, rich people getting to buy levels of influence?
Well, I totally agree with not buying levels of influence. I separate my role as a donor and expert. So if you ask me as a donor, I say I'm giving money to Kamala Harris because I think she's the best future president for the U.S., for business, for a bunch of other things. If you ask me as an expert about what, you know, kind of Lina Khan is doing and whether I think she is helping or hurting America relative to your anti-merger policies, which are, you know, mostly to bring litigation versus, you know, really solidly grounded in kind of what's going on, what helps American business thrive here and overseas, then I give an expert opinion. But I think donor and expert should be kept separate. And I've never tied the two ever in any conversation anywhere I've ever had.
Right. But I mean, that world doesn't really exist where people say, okay, now I'm talking to Reid Hoffman, the donor, and Reid Hoffman, the guy with political ideas, I'm going to put into the other room. I mean, politicians are human, and if they know that you and Barry Diller and other big donors are giving a lot of cash and want to get rid of Lina Khan from the FTC, they might listen to that more than they would listen to it from somebody in a restaurant.
Well, you know, this is one of the things where I don't ever show up at the White House saying, I think you should do this. I mean, one of the things that President Biden has said to me every time he's met me is I never ask for anything, because all that I'm trying to do is help our leaders be the best governors.
So look, going back to Jan Mayer's point about Kamala Harris and her messaging that seems to echo some sort of economic populism, I think we all need to keep our eyes on Lina Khan and what happens with the priorities of all of these billionaire mega donors who are promising to spend tens of millions of dollars to make sure that Kamala Harris gets elected. Is she going to take all that money and then govern in a way that's against their interests? All I know is that these guys have been able to accumulate so much money because they're smart about what they invest in. And I don't think that they're going to spend tens of millions of dollars on a political campaign for candidates who are going to hurt their pocketbook. They're smart investors, right? That's why they're billionaires.
I mean, if TikToks are only seconds long, it makes me wonder whether the content of the political message that campaigns can transmit is now being reduced to just, you know, something that's minuscule. And what does that do to the sort of political dialogue in the country? I mean, are kids basically only able to sort of hear fights over things that are 15 seconds long?
This is a funny and good question from someone who has zero idea how TikTok works. Luckily, they had on a guest this week who's an expert in political advertising, who understands the basics of social media and can explain them to Jan Mayer.
The hook is really short. So the TikTok ad or the TikTok video is hooking you in to learn a little bit more about the candidate. So in the new Kamala Harris ads, for example, or you know what we're seeing on TikTok, it's about freedom and the future.
And then does that then lead to sort of going further down the rabbit hole to learn more about why freedom is the word for her?
In an ideal world. We're still a little bit unclear as to how that trickle-down effect works, but the upside to social media and the fact that so many of these ads are not aired on broadcast TV is that they can be longer than 30 seconds too.
Aha! Internet videos can be longer than political advertisements as well. That is useful information to know if you're trying to cover politics in 2024. Now, even though we are in 2024, we're about to travel back to the 1990s. So buckle up, everybody.
I mean, everybody of my generation, anyway, worried that we've seen what was done to Hillary Clinton. And obviously, there's been no female who's been able to win the presidency. How do you think Kamala Harris is handling that? It seems, you know, where Hillary Clinton had to apologize for saying she didn't want to just stay home and bake cookies, we now see Kamala Harris actually in the kitchen and talking about cooking, which she enjoys. So I wonder, you know, how do you see how they're handling that?
Gather around, kids. So it was 1992, and then Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton was running for president as a Democrat. His wife and the First Lady of Arkansas, wait, is that what you call the wife of a governor? You call them the First Lady of that state? I'm not sure. But anyway, Hillary Rodham Clinton was asked in an interview about the role she played in her husband's life in the run-up to the presidential election that he ended up winning in spectacular fashion. Here's how she answered that question at the time.
I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life.
Now that clip ended up becoming a bit of a Rorschach test that reflected how Americans felt about second-wave feminism. Of course, Hillary Clinton, who studied hard and worked her whole life, went to Yale Law School and became an accomplished attorney, didn't want to give up that career just because her husband became a successful politician. But what upset a lot of women at the time was the inference that staying home and baking cookies, i.e. being a housewife, was somehow inferior to the life of a career woman. And so it ended up becoming political fodder, not just in 1992, but for several elections since then, including during her own run for the White House in 2016. So that's a little bit of the context that the New Yorker political scene host didn't give that I thought would be useful to some of our audiences who might be young enough not to remember the 1992 presidential election.
When Hillary Clinton said she wasn't just going to stay home and bake cookies, it was the early 90s. And so that stuck with her. So even when she was running for president in 2008 and 2016, this statement from a much earlier time was something that she just couldn't shed. And as a result, I think a quarter of a century of interaction with the media, of familiarity among American voters. Everybody knew everything they possibly could about Hillary Clinton, and they could all glom onto something that they didn't like. And as a result, I think she was held to a standard that was very, very different than most other candidates. We've only had one woman win the nomination for president. And so it's hard to know whether the way that she was treated and the way that gender stereotypes played a role had to do with the fact that she was a woman or had to do with the fact that she was Hillary Clinton.
Of course, it's impossible to ever know how much misogyny hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. You'll never be able to conduct the experiment where you have the male equivalent of Hillary Clinton, and then you run both of those candidates in otherwise identical circumstances. But what I do believe is, if you're running to be the president of the United States, you're asking to be perhaps the most powerful person in the world. And you need essentially hundreds of millions of people to believe that you're an exceptional leader and to then bequeath you with that power. That is not a job that is owed to anyone. That is a job that has to be earned. Anyone who finds himself in that position should be an incredibly exceptional person. I would argue that you as a person should be able to transcend forces like sexism in order to convince enough people to vote for you. Now, if you're not able to do that, either the country we live in is rotten, or you simply weren't a good enough candidate to win. And maybe in 2016, a combination of those two things was true.
And the fact that Kamala Harris is not running away from any of those kinds of stereotypes, the fact that she's able to talk about cooking, that she's able to talk about a blended family, that she doesn't have to talk about her role as mother versus wife versus elected official, demonstrates that there has been progress. And we don't only have to look at the presidential level to see that progress. The number of women in Congress in the last 25 years has more than doubled. We've seen a 50% increase in the percentage of women serving in state legislatures. So we've seen more and more women from different backgrounds emerge as successful politicians. And that allows people, I think, to chip away at some stereotypical ideas they have about women and men in general, but women and men as elected leaders in particular.
Okay, so I realized just now that I never named the person who's talking here, the guest on this week's episode of The Political Scene. Her name is Jennifer Lawless. She's a professor of politics and public policy at the University of Virginia. And I have to say, I basically agree with everything she's saying here. But don't fret, I will have some negative things to say about the way that Professor Lawless frames the issue of immigration in this next clip.
I think it'll be an incredibly negative campaign season, there's no question. And we're already seeing with immigration the idea that she's personally responsible for, according to the Trump campaign, for allowing undocumented workers and illegal immigrants into the country who then commit crimes. And the footage is incredibly compelling. The personal stories that we saw at the RNC are very, very compelling. It doesn't matter if this is systematic. It doesn't matter how unusual it is. You need one good example and a couple of good visuals for an ad. And so on the immigration front, I expect that we are going to see the 2024 equivalent of Willie Horton.
Okay, everybody, let's get back in the time machine. The year is 1988, and the Democratic governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis, is running for president against George H.W. Bush. So in 1974, a man named William Horton, together with two accomplices, stabbed a 17-year-old gas station attendant 19 times during a robbery and stuffed his body into a trash can. Horton was convicted of murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, but in 1986, while Michael Dukakis was the governor, Horton was released as a part of a furlough program where people could leave prison for a weekend, but he never returned. Then about a year later, he brutally attacked a woman and her fiancé, stole his car, and was later shot by police. So that story was the subject of attacks on Michael Dukakis by the George H.W. Bush campaign, who said that if it weren't for Dukakis overseeing this furlough program, this woman would never have been raped, her fiancé never would have been assaulted. And in speaking about the case, George H.W. Bush referred to Horton as Willie Horton and not William Horton. Horton never went by the nickname Willie, and so a lot of people remember this as an example of dog whistle politics, because the George H.W. Bush campaign was using a horrific story to epitomize the results of progressive policies on criminal justice reform while speaking about a black man who, yes, was convicted of committing horrific acts, but was referred to in a diminutive way, in a way that resonated with the base of the Republican Party. Again, I'm just hoping to provide you with a little bit of context that the New Yorker Political Scene's hosts failed to.
on the immigration front, I expect that we are going to see the 2024 equivalent of Willie Horton, where we see these people coming into the country and committing crimes, and it's all Kamala Harris's fault. That said, Kamala Harris has a lot of ammunition that she can use against Donald Trump as well. It might be about immigration. There might be a pushback. We're already seeing one immigration ad that she has put forward that suggests that the Biden-Harris administration cracked down on immigration in a way that the Trump campaign and the Trump team and administration had not been able to.
Now, as someone who, for various reasons, spends a lot of time focusing on U.S. immigration policy, I've long noticed this tendency among Democrats, which is, since the emergence of Donald Trump, who basically distinguished himself from all modern presidential candidates because of the way he talked about immigrants and immigration, Democrats have responded by trying to sell themselves as the more humanitarian option. So when Donald Trump was in office, you saw a lot of very justified criticism of his immigration policies. But then when Democrats have to campaign in a presidential election, they're scared of seeming weak on the border. So all of that humanism goes out the window. And as the good doctor is pointing out, the Harris campaign will likely pivot to the right on immigration and try to make it seem like they're cracking down on immigrants more than Donald Trump is. Now, you can get into the politics of it and make the argument that that position could help you win the election. But if you're someone who wants to see a more humane immigration policy, you don't really have an option. At least that's the dynamic that's emerged rhetorically since the 2020 election.